on Refuge and on Ego. That seemed to be kind of a topic. And we work so hard with it, trying to get rid of it. But as long as we're trying to get rid of it, all we're doing is solidifying the concept. Because there is no it. It is simply the story we have created about who and what we are. And then because it's simply a story, a concept, so it's not solid, not really real, so anytime it's challenged, we react. It is important to recognize that we pay so much attention to ego, to our problem-solving, moving mind. We must recognize ego for what it is, simply an identity of pain. We have constant dialogue of pain talking to pain, which is what usually guides us or drives us, sometimes driving us crazy. And no matter how smart or sophisticated, ego only operates within the logic of pain, of dissatisfaction, of non-presence, and therefore produces more pain. Perhaps it's time to discover that there is something other than ego to turn towards and to trust. And it's, I mean, how often during the day are we saying, I think, I want, I have to go, Who is that I that we keep throwing out there? It is our belief in our identity, our I, that is the fundamental problem. As human beings, we are storytellers. Man, we have stories about everything. And we got a lot of stories about us and ones that we don't even realize are stories. I mean, all the stories I have about me, I mean, of course they're true. I forget I created them. The relative mind involves the imagination of ego. The story that is woven of thoughts, images that may appear intelligent, but fail to recognize the truth of the fundamental separation it causes from our essential nature. Do you want me to repeat that? The relative mind, the pain mind, involves the imagination of ego. The story that is woven of thoughts and images that may appear intelligent, but fail to recognize the truth of the fundamental separation from our essential nature. So, when we have those moments of grace, it doesn't feel right because we can't create a story to go with it. It's just being. And we're used to telling the story. Maybe in some way, our story about ourselves was our first refuge. And when it ceased to really work, created more suffering, we had to look elsewhere. It's just a thought. We are not our stories. And no matter how smart or sophisticated the storyteller is, the relative mind cannot liberate us from the suffering we experience. Cannot. We can try to figure it out, we can try to go over, under, around, bust our way through, it's not going to work. It's only on the experiential level. We can read all about it and get an incredible amount of knowledge, but that's not going to do it. One of the reasons, I think, that Tibetans practiced debate, philosophical debate, because the answers had to be from experience or they would lose the debate. So it wasn't how much they knew, it was how much what they had studied integrated, became a part of who they were and how they perceived the world. Kind of tricky coming up with that, wasn't it? I mean, how clever. Man, how did these guys, 10, 15, 18,000 feet up there, in really primitive circumstances, while the Western world was going through the Industrial Revolution and all of this, they were writing commentaries and discovering termas on things that it would take the rest of the world hundreds of years to even begin to approach. And yet in the poets, in the artists, you see it glimmering through. What does liberate suffering? The moment you have some glimpse that you are bigger than what you are thinking or feeling, is a healing moment. And in the interviews, I told about when I was living in New York City long before Dharma, and really there was anxiety and depression, and it was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I was walking down Greenwich Street, constricted, not seeing anything around me. And I looked up and there was a tree and I saw the sun glinting off the dew on a leaf. I mean, 50 years later, I can feel that moment, because what happened, whatever conceptual bounds, wherever I was at with that depression. They just exploded, and all of a sudden, oh my God, there really is more. I didn't have a context to put it in for many, many years. There's always more. Have a glimpse that you are bigger than what you are thinking or feeling is a healing moment. In such a moment, the false sense of I, the story, begins to lose its grip. Through meditation, noticing this disillusion of a solid self is encouraged by drawing your attention to the sense of being itself. The moment that false sense of I starts to dissipate, you begin to feel different. If you trust in the space that opens up, you can discover a deeper support than the reactivity of your ego. That deeper support is the inner refuge. We've all had those moments of awakening, of opening up, no matter how brief. Use the feeling. I mean, I can go back that 50 years and use that feeling that arose in me on Greenwich Street as the space in which I sit down to meditate. Then it's not something I'm doing. It becomes a totality of experience. If I remember it when I'm walking down the street, or use that when I feel constricted or fear arises. It dissipates. Because it's reminding me that that reality is much larger than any momentary fear, upset, attachment, anger that can possibly arise, that arises because of our holding on to our concept of self, our story about who and what we are. Any comments?
Well, I wonder, you know, I think it's interesting that kids these days, you know, say awesome so much, like, oh, awesome, awesome, awesome. And it's like, that's not awesome at all.
You
know? Like,
you don't know awesome.
So this sense of awe, I think for many of us, you know, there's a higher probability we'll experience that sense of awe or this moment of understanding in nature, you know, because, you know, you look and the clouds do this thing or this rainbow or, you know, some bird, you know, I mean, something happens in nature. I'm just wondering, though, if that's, you know, if there are any hints or other ways of encountering that more reliably, cultivating it when we're not in somewhere where it's very conducive to it, like, you know, in nature, or, you know, I mean, we turned this very plain hall into sort of an awesome space in a way. I mean, you know, there's so much, you know, we were talking about the tankas at lunch or the after lunch, you know, there's so much richness here that it's very inspirational and awesome. So I wonder if you have, you know, like you couldn't have known, you didn't have any sort of right to expect walking down Greenwich Street that the sun would hit the dew at just that angle.
And I would look up.
And you would, you know, be there. So, you know, sort of the odds were against you there. But it happens. And probably there are, you know, maybe there are 10,000 moments every day where we just aren't looking in the right direction, or we're inside when the rainbow's outside, or whatever.
I think it's happening every moment. And I think we aren't seeing it. It's not that we're looking in the wrong place, because wherever we look, it's happening every moment, mm-hmm. but we aren't present to it.
Yeah, and I can see that for us sort of beginners, you know, we're not as attuned and we need to practice, so we learn better when somehow Mother Nature or whoever hits us with a stick, you know, because then it's like, wake up, you know, pay attention. And as you've been helping us relearn this weekend, this idea of sort of present moment awareness, the more that we can experience it in practice, like by meditating or by, you know, being deliberate about our actions, etc., the more it becomes an easy state to just be in all the time. You know, this, the more we practice it, the better we get at it. So,
and practice is all 24 hours.
Right. But I think I'm missing a lot of those hours. You know.
Well, but if we go to sleep with that aspiration, mm-hmm. and wake up with it first thing, mm-hmm. in the morning, that makes a huge difference, rather than, oh my God, I don't feel like going to work. What we've already created a problematic day. I remember back in Cambridge, I don't know why this, there were two other things I'm thinking about that really stood out. Once I was walking down the street and I looked up at the horizon, and it was the first time I saw the whole scope of it, rather than just the thing I was looking at. And I had just a little understanding of how an artist saw, that I had never had. The only words I could put to it were wide-angle vision. And of course, I forgot the other one. I remember spending time with Toku Tunduk once, and it was before the first time I went to India. And I had the feeling that every time I turned a corner, I was saying goodbye, to that somehow I would never see anything that I had taken as my reality again. I didn't know what that meant. And I told Toku Tundup about it. And I said there was a real sadness And he said it was grieving because everything was in the process of change. And true grieving is the first step to true compassion. And I remember when he talked to me, he wasn't looking directly at me. It was just he and I in his apartment near Harvard. And he was looking like kind of past me a little bit. And I mean, I had such a feeling that whatever he was saying was said to me, and where I was in that moment. And when I came back from India, everything was different. My relationship with everything had changed. Because my view had shifted, and so what I needed and what I wanted and all of that had all totally changed. So my relationship with the external world and my internal world was all different. Because I had, in those 4 months, I had moved into Dharma in a way that I hadn't previously. Every moment there's change going on, and the egoic mind relates change to dying. And yet, in the very real sense, dying is just stepping through a doorway from one reality into another. It's not the end in the way that we fear so much. But that's one of the reasons we're fighting so much against changing. Letting go of our concept of ego, and we even fight ourselves in meditation. Any comments?
Well, yeah, I've been thinking about this, what you've been saying, and I feel like I spend, certainly not all the time, but I certainly have, significant long periods of time where, during a day or during a sort of a period of time in my life when I feel like I'm pretty aware, pretty there. Maybe I'm not it's not like a peak experience, and I've had a lot of those, but I'm trying to sort of. But with my peak experiences, my really transcendent experiences, they've always sometimes lasted for several days, but then it kind of fades. It kind of fades slowly, typically, although occasionally there's a really specific thought that comes in that helps shift it. But I think that the everyday experience of being present is not the same as those high experiences. I mean, or that's my question, I guess, because for me, the really transcendent experiences of my life feel in a kind of different category than the other times in my life when I feel very present and very focused and very, I really feel like I'm there, I'm pretty settled, I'm not worried or afraid or whatever, I'm kind of engaged in the moment. But it doesn't have that ecstatic kind of feel to it. It has a more everyday, normal quality to it.
Can somebody help illuminate why it doesn't have uh, a complete experience, let's say?
Well, I would give a sort of a neuroscience answer, Bob. It says, you know, your neurotransmitters are only good for so long. You run out of neurotransmitters.
Oh,
so
maybe,
you know, from
that's
a physical point of view, I think, you know, I mean, I really do think that, you know, these peak experiences, you know, an experience of awe, I think it, I mean, there's stuff going on in your brain, you know, there's real stuff, you know, and, you know, so on a physical level, I just don't think it's possible to sustain that, you know, just like you can't sustain fear, you know, intense fear for so long that you, like, starve to death, you know what I mean?
But, well, that fits my experience of kind of...
Anybody else?
Isn't that what you're saying lamas can do, though?
Well, you have to realize that each transcendent experience we have changes our makeup within our vibrational field and our brain. So we slowly become more and more attuned to being there.
Okay, I agree with that, actually. Yeah.
But what was the fallacy about what he was saying?
And then it goes away? Maybe nothing goes away, but his attention goes elsewhere.
Yeah, but what else? What was dualistic about everything he was saying?
Mind, body.
I.
Okay, sure.
Of course it was mundane. I feel like I was... I remember in response to that, Rinpoche saying to me once, it's like you can't be a little bit pregnant. You're either there or you're not. It's like the difference between relative bodhicitta and absolute. One is the working towards. The problem is if we convince ourselves we're already there, then we're stuck. And I'm not saying you haven't had the experiences, but this is a place that everybody gets stuck.
Well, along those same lines, like I know, I get what you're saying, because I've had those same sorts of experiences, but I think that's why they always say not to cling on to, you know, those sorts of awesome experiences, and you know, try to produce something from them, because your memory of it is not what you experienced.
It's
anyway.
Experience.
It's you're experiencing a memory of something that you actually is ineffable.
Yeah, the lamas would say it's not good, it's not bad, let it go. I mean, you go in, you've got this great story of what happened. It's not good, it's not bad, let it go. Or bah, nothing.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was reading something about writing the other day, and they said, they quoted some old chestnut for writers, which I'd never heard before, and it said, stories happen only to the people who can tell them. And I thought, you know, because I think about my kids sometimes, and I think, you know, they're not doing that many interesting things in their lives, and it's like, what kind of stories are they going to be able to tell? You know, like they didn't go hitchhiking to, you know, Haight-Ashbury or whatever. You know, they're not. In my view, you know, they're not building those stories. I'm sure they're building their own stories that are probably generationally appropriate. But, you know, this thing about, you know, when we tell the story of a peak experience, I think it's a way of reminding. It's like returning to the breath. You know, when you're meditating, you know, you've been distracted. But I think you can change yourself by recalling something that happened decades ago, even though it's a memory or it's a story, and maybe the story of the peak experience is actually better than what really happened at the time, because you've made it better by the story, which, I mean, maybe there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know.
Well,
if it has the effect.
I don't know. I mean, there's a story, say, about walking down Greenwich Street, but the feeling that arose that moment of seeing the leaf, that's not a story. Mm-hmm. That I re-experienced, and when I started meditating, that was the space, mm-hmm. that memory was the space I sat down and meditated in.
But what really struck me about what you said is using, I mean, I don't know that this is the only thing that you would do it, but at the aspiration, for me, that was a real key. That if I aspire, you know, if that memory of that peak experience creates an aspiration within me or is conducive to aspiration, then that, you know, that gets the ball rolling in the right direction,
yeah.
where I want to be going. So,
yeah.
So I think it is helpful to recall those peak experiences and those memories, because, you know, that could get you out on a rainy day to go hiking, or, you know, or what, or get you onto your cushion, or get you to,
whatever.
You know, give a guy a dollar on the street or whatever. I don't know.
You know, I agree with that. That's certainly true for me, too. The experiences I'm talking about were, you know, really powerful experiences of love, really, you know, like for one, just to make it real, like, although my father died when I was 12, and at a certain point, after doing a bunch of sort of therapy and stuff in my 30s, I got in touch with all that grief over my father, and it wiped me out. I mean, for about several hours of just intense tears, and then I spent the next 3 days, like I loved everybody, I totally loved everybody, and nothing happened that disturbed that feeling, you know, and it was just, I mean, it was a fabulous experience, totally. It was an experience of love, you know, no question. It was the pent-up love for my father. And so many times, that has totally motivated through me through my life to meditate, to explore, to do lots of things, really. But the experience of that really peak high is different than the other times when I'm just feeling, you know, productive and present and like your father, the woodworker, you know? You know, that kind of presence. And I have that too, you know? But that kind of presence has a really different feeling than that kind of almost ecstatic high of this tremendous pent-up love.
Right, and I think I equate presence with the moment of grace. I mean, it really being present is there's a point at which we can go about our lives with a certain amount of clarity. It's not quite presence in the sense I'm talking about, but it's there is a joy and an ease.
Yeah. Okay. Right. But it is a little different than you're using presence in the sense of a really expansive peak.
A peak experience,
yeah.
Like Maslow referred to.
Yeah.
It. To go back to the 60s. Anybody else?
So you think the lamas that you've experienced sort of revert after they tend to their airplane ticket, they revert back to this really expansive?
I think they rest in their natural state without question. That is what is familiar. And then in order to deal, most of them, remember, had people doing all the stuff for them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If they're doing it for themselves, then it's dealing with something dualistically. And they have to narrow their view, dealing with a bank account or deciding what their schedule is going to be and where they're going to be at certain times. And it's not a big deal, but then they just naturally go back resting in their natural state. And And since we think this natural state is we're trying to find it and do everything we can to experience it, but it's always there. It never went anywhere. And when we get out of the way, the experience arises. Anybody else?
So the term equanimity comes to mind in this discussion, and in particular, trying to have a sense of what that might be or mean. I mean, there's a common sense understanding that has to do with not being buffeted about every emotion or every thought. But I'm also hearing you define kind of a state of being that is a resting in the natural state. Is that what we're talking about when we use the phrase equanimity? Because earlier,
it doesn't matter what we've been talking about, whether it's arising compassion or love or equanimity. It all arises from the natural state. First, we practice it to have an understanding. And then, hopefully, at some point, something jars us into an experience where things start arising on their own. Like when I made the reference, like first there's relative, but bodhicitta, where we practice, and then there's absolute, where it is arising spontaneously.
Would you be interested in this context of saying anything about your 3-year retreat? How did that feel? Not that it's that, but I mean, what is the state of mind in a 3-year retreat, and kind of in context of this discussion?
Aside from all the practices and all the sitting and all that, one of the major advantages is when stuff arises, you've got no one to blame. So you got to look at your own mind. And when Rinpoche came to visit me in the middle of it, he never asked me what I had done or anything else. What he wanted to know was what were my experiences. So it didn't allow me to say, oh, I finished the 13 million Guru Rinpoche mantras, or what was your experience? I never even told him any of that. He would just say, have you finished it? Yes. What are your experiences? That is what is important.
And that's very much what Geshe Jangyang does, after our meditation.
Oh, good.
Yeah, every week.
I'm hoping I'm not going too far afield.
Pretty much every week.
Because that's the way a teacher can get a measure of where a student is. It's not through what you have done, but what your experiences are.
What are you holding? The green. Oh. I didn't know if it was symbolic.
I think it is so cute. And it kind of sucks into the cup and keeps it warm. I've never seen anything like that before.
So when Rinpoche asked about your experience, he was wanting to know, did you have periods of happiness or boredom or, you know, depression?
No.
No? Not like that?
No. Okay. That's all relative.
Okay.
I remember when he asked me, first I was running around my mind trying to find the right answer. And I started to say something, no. And then somehow I went back into the meditation and the words came on their own. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember what that was, but it seems that's what he was waiting for. Experiential.
Yeah, I know. That's the word that's always used, and that's why I'm sort of trying to dig into what do we mean by that word in this context.
I don't know that feelings or emotions that arise or upsets or depression... I got another story that reminds me. Are experiential in that sense because they are all story produced. That's actually a very good way of saying that.
The thought that arose was he wanted the experience where you weren't I.
Yes. Yes. Where I got out of the way. And that's, I mean, part of it, the only warning he gave me at the beginning was, remember, people can sit on their bottom, do all the practices, and nothing happens. In fact, they come out a little bit, I did the 3-year retreat. That's equivalent to, let's see, a master's degree, so that's how much I have to charge for interviews.
Yeah, right.
And there are ones out there who do that.
For me, those moments that we're sort of talking about as highs really don't feel like highs. They feel like something to do with the itness of things.
Mm-hmm.
That they're, yeah, it may be accompanied by a kind of a wonderful sensation, but the only way I can describe it is to say there's an itness to things that I see now that I didn't necessarily see. Does that make any sense?
That makes sense, and I don't know if I used the word high.
No, you didn't.
Okay, good.
We said peak experiences, did we? Maybe, so I may have misspoken there. But the peak experiences are not about necessarily...
They're a moment of immersion in the moment.
Yeah, which for me was the moment was about the innocent things.
And each one of us are going to find our own way of making sense of it. Like, how often have you been in a group where somebody was raised Catholic, so they have a problem with one phrasing? Or, and it's really always a matter of getting beyond the word. Any other comments? Let's take, it's 2 minutes till, let's take, let's reconvene at 10 after. 15 minutes. Stretch your legs, breathe some air outside, lay on the grass.